Good morning. I'd like to welcome you. For the few of you I don't know, I'm Mary Augusta Thomas, the Associate Director of Smithsonian Libraries. And this is the sixth in our series on the future of libraries. We've been really pleased with our series to date. It's helped give us a lot of new ideas. It's brought some new people together. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how we've done this series. We're looking forward as part of our strategic planning and our 40th anniversary year. This is our Ruby anniversary, and we thought instead of just looking back at what we've done, we'd try something a little different. As I mentioned, this is the sixth in that series, and we are lucky to have the co-sponsorship of the Smithsonian Archives and the Office of the Chief Information Officer to help make this work. So I'm very happy to have you join us this morning. I think you're in for a good morning. I have had the luck of hearing David Lankus before, in fact twice this year, and each time I've come away with something new and something that I think is probably an idea that keeps at me for a while, so I'm sure we'll have the same. I can say that because I went on Virtual Dave this morning, which is his site, and I actually cheated. For those of you who think you're in the Elements of Fiction writing class and like to go to the end of the novel first, you could actually take time and go take a look really quickly, although I'm sure hearing David talk will be more interesting than just looking at his slides. David is currently the director of the Information Institute at Syracuse and a professor in Syracuse University's School of Information Studies. He's an advocate of participatory librarianship, and that I'm sure will help be focused on in his remarks this morning. I'm not going to say anything much else about him because I think we want the time spent with David. So welcome, and welcome to all of you.
Take the short way. Good morning. Thanks for coming. It is an honor to be invited to the Smithsonian. I have had the privilege of working with the Smithsonian going back to the Joan of Arc days, the National Museum of American Art, and Joan Stahl, with a project answering education questions and working on some of the issues of digital reference around that. And before that, I had the great privilege of having a plaque with Ask Eric, a project I work on, sitting up in the American History Museum, which I'm sure through the construction is now covered in dust. But it hopefully will come back. But my true Smithsonian fanboy status began when I was six, and my mother and grandmother drove in from Ohio so that we could go see the Smithsonian, and they took me to the ice cream parlor in the basement, and you had me at hot fudge. You had me at hot fudge. So here's what I'd like to do today. I understand that we have folks from archives and museums here as well. Duh. So I hope you'll help me extend the comments, but I'm going to start really on librarianship, and let me begin to give you sort of an overview of where I want to head with this. I chose this graphic actually from your collection, so thanks again for that, because I think it reflects a little bit of what we want to do here. We want to do a little bit of looking at the sky and looking for portents in our future, but really we also want to ground that in what we do today. I give a lot of these talks, and I hear a lot of these talks, and one of the sort of standard warnings I give to audiences is beware of prophets who speak loudly. You know, it's really easy for me to get up here and tell you what you need to do and then leave. The hard part is then having to do something about it. And some of the advice I give in terms of sort of trying to decipher what you hear from talking heads, one of which is there reality behind what they're talking? Is there a deep concept is fine, but do they have a sense of how that actually gets implemented? And we spent about a year on some of these concepts, spending time right across the mall over at Department of Justice and the Philadelphia Free Library and other folks talking about how some of these concepts could be concrete. So I give this as a sort of hold on. You know, we're going to start up in the ether, but I want to make our way down to the muck. And actually, this is a good graphic because what I love about it is the librarians will quickly cue on the books below and see what Library of Congress classification they have. But so the other thing is I spent some time preparing, and luckily you put most of your speakers online, so I was able to watch the competition, as it were. And one of the things I noted, which is as they talk about the future, they all bring a sort of different lens to it. So either there's a discussion about really tactics and technology happening, or trends, or policy and legal issues. And it's probably not going to be so surprising that as an academic, I want to start with theory and conceptual framework. And I'll make a case for why that's important. But I'll start early with this quote. To practice without theory is to sail in an uncharted sea. Theory without practice is not to set sail at all. And those are really great grand terms, but I found a better one online, which is, to me, theory is like vegetables. I don't like eating it, but I realize I have to stay healthy. It's sort of interesting that at times we have this real love-hate relationship with theory and conceptual frameworks. And frankly, within the library profession at least, we've become so process-oriented, we have a hard time even identifying and seeing how theory is relevant. We spend a lot of time worrying about the daily how do we do, and we spend a lot less time with why do we do. And we spend almost no time with what is it that we do that can help us with the next thing that we need to do. And so I want to spend a good amount of time thinking about those. The other thing I'll do right before I jump into my slides is I'll highlight that down in the corner, for those of you who see the slides afterwards or want to click on them, is a lot of what I'm going to say is pretty dense stuff, and I'm going to hit sort of the highlights. But if you want to sort of explore an idea down deep or further, that's what these little URLs are for if you want to follow it. So I'm going to start with a question. And I'm sure it's a question that you've asked as part of this process. And in a little while, I'm going to tell you why that's a really bad question. But let's start with it. What is the future of libraries? This is a question that was given to me by the MacArthur Foundation when they wanted us to think about, go out and think about what is the future of libraries. We want trends, we want what's being thought about, what's not being thought about, who's saying it, all of those things. And what's interesting is, so I hopped on the phone and I called public library directors and academic library directors and, you know, the big head people, and we talked to library science educators and theorists, and we asked them this question. And what I took away as very positive is that I got a remarkably similar answer from all of them. First of all, no one asked, why the heck are you asking that question? That's a stupid question to ask. I think that we've always sort of thought about what is the future, but at times it's been, we don't have time for that, it's not an important question, it's irrelevant. But increasingly, I think it is a very relevant question. People are willing to and interested in talking about our future. And what's nice is they're willing to and interested in talking about the future, and not out of fear and panic, or fear and loathing in library land, as we called it. If you went to any sort of library conferences, and I'm sure museum conferences and archives conferences in the past, say 5 years ago, you probably heard the Google Talks, where it was impossible to talk about the future of libraries without talking about Google. And the idea was, they're going to put us out of business, we got to take them on, it's like, you know, let's rumble in the parking lot with Google, and, you know, and it was a really fearful time to talk about the future. A lot of libraries were sitting there going, well, what is our role? Oh, it may not exist. And now when you talk about it, I think you find that people have answers. In fact, this is a representation of the kind of answers we got. And before I go into the bits and pieces, I should warn you that one of the things I found very disturbing was that you would call up a public library director and you'd say, what is the future of libraries? And the public library would say, well, I can't talk about academic or special libraries because they're screwed. They're out of business. But in public libraries, it's a bright future where we're going to be about learning and educational communal spaces. And so I'd call up an academic library director. And they'd say, well, I can't talk about public libraries or special libraries because they're screwed. But in academic libraries, we have a bright future in learning and interesting educational spaces. And when I talk to special, you get the point, is that I think sometimes we like to subdivide ourselves to such a level that we forget that we come from a common core. So what I hope this vision, when I present this vision, and part of why I'm going to talk why that question is a bad question, is this is not a vision of the special libraries or of the academic libraries or of the public libraries, but I really feel from talking around that this is a pretty common vision across the field. So the first bullet up there, that librarians, their skills and preparation are the key to the future of libraries. We no longer spend a huge amount of time saying that our future is rested solely in the collection, or rested solely in our buildings. It really is that if we're going to continue to survive as a field, we need to spend a lot of time with the people in it. Barbara Quint talked a lot about the library after closing hours is like the coral reef without the fish. You know, and in fact, if you look at a lot of our websites, it's about the same way, which is we see the artifact, what's left over from all this interesting, intelligent, professional work, and then we just see, you know, we look at the shelves and say, that's it. But that's not it. That's the outcome. That's the what's left over from the really interesting stuff. So librarians. And I'm not going to spend too much time here, but I think we need to spend a lot of time on how we prepare and train librarians, because I think the notion that a two-year master's degree at the beginning of your career is not all that it takes to be and maintain as a librarian. I actually want to see an undergraduate librarian degree and a doctoral degree, but that's me. The library's place will continue to play an important but different role in libraries. The library will become a much more trusted community. And that was the notion that we're not going to close them all. Once we digitize our artifacts, we don't have to close the door. People will still show up, but they'll probably be doing different things. And in fact, one of the things that we've noticed across it is that it used to be that you would build the library and you would build loud rooms, places to contain loud action. And now we build loud libraries and we build quiet rooms within them. And I think that's a really interesting trend. Education and learning will be at the core of library services. We'll talk a lot more about that, but the notion that we are all in the education world is an interesting one. I, for example, am very heartened by the fact that when I go to the Smithsonian Institute webpage, it ends in .edu, and I think that's a pretty appropriate thing to happen. The information world is increasingly digital. We really don't need to go much further than that. There is a need for better data. That a lot of times what we do out of practice, but we don't always do it out of data. I was at a library, which was very interesting, and I asked how many people do they have coming to their libraries, and they had no idea. I asked how many people use their online catalog, and they had no idea. And what was very interesting is they brought me in to talk about buying a new library catalog, and they wanted this to be a foundation. They wanted this. They said, you know, the library catalog is where we should build all these cool services that involve and bring users into it. We should build on that foundation. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And we were talking a little bit more, and they mentioned the fact that their library catalog went down for a month. A month. They had three complaints. They had served this population of slightly more than three, right? They had hundreds of people who used it. This was a law library very close to us. And they said that what happens is when the lawyers have questions, they pick up the phone and they call the librarian. The librarian uses the catalog. They were complaining. But the patron didn't see it, didn't care, didn't know. And so the question becomes, if you have no real data about how it's being used, why are you picking this as the foundation where you're going to build new systems? So having real data to make those choices, and particularly nationwide and international data so we can do true comparisons against peer institutions. Federal and global policies on the intellectual property, openness of government information and privacy outside the library will have a huge impact. And I know that you had a speaker talking specifically about copyright, so I won't spend much time there because I'm not a lawyer, nor do I play one on TV. But it's true that libraries exist as a fiat of policy that can be changed. And I think that's a scary and dangerous thing. But the other thing that I'm going to draw your attention to is this conclusion. Put bluntly, technology and trends in the information industry are dominating discussions of the future of libraries and drowning out the more profound discussion of how libraries can be trusted sources of information in the proper functioning of society. A lot of times when we talk future, it's kind of like that 50s view of the future, which is it's all jetpacks and Lycra. And, you know, the future is going to be really cool and whiz-bang, and that's awesome. And I think what oftentimes is when we think future, we look for something that we can plug in. We look for something that has digital and electricity and such. And really, we spend a lot of time spending what is Google doing, what is Amazon doing, what's happening on the Internet, and we don't spend a lot of time going, well, what is our profound mission and what do we add to this equation? So I'm not going to kill this too much until I kill it later. But so let me come back to this refining the question. And why is this a bad question? As an academic, we spend a lot of time on questions. And questions are important things. If you don't ask the right question, you can never get the right answer. And so why do I think that this is a bad question? Well, first of all, I think there's two parts, a couple parts. First of all, whenever I was calling these people up on the phone, I said, what is the future of libraries? They instantly started with, you mean in public? Do you mean in academic? Do you mean, so it was the segmentation. And then they would start with, well, the future in terms of the collection, in terms of, in other words, it's too easy for people to look at and begin to pick apart. The other thing, what I think is profoundly bad about this question is, what answer are you going to get? What if the answer is, there is no future for libraries? Are you happy with that? Is that it? You can close doors, you're done? It's the sense that somehow the future happens to us and we are just going along. Now, the truth is the future will show up if we wait long enough, but it really is a passive sense of this, and I think that's really problematic. And so I was having this conversation with colleagues who train future librarians, and someone said, you know, are you asking what is or what should be the future of libraries? And the answer, because if it is, and you say libraries are going to get smaller and they're going to go away and we're all done, are you happy with it, or do you want to actively go out and shape that future? As Alan Kay once said, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And so it became this real interesting discussion at the academic level of, are we observing a phenomenon or are we trying to influence a phenomenon? Now, you guys don't have that because you're in the phenomenon. But it was a really interesting question, and I think we need to end up on the should be. Because I think we need to look at an ideal state. If you look at where we are and you look at where those trends take us, they may be one point. But then if you say, this is where we want to be, it may be a radically different point. But knowing where you want to be lets you back up in terms of strategy, in terms of questions, in terms of data. If you want the library to be really important, the question doesn't become, will the library be really important? It's how to make the library really important. We need to shift our questions from being passive reflections to being active constructors of that. Now, the other thing coming from the data was that we really are talking about the future of libraries and librarians. We know, for example, in the special library community that more and more and more and more of our librarians don't sit in the library. And more of our librarians don't actually report to someone called a librarian. They're in the CIO's office, they're in technology offices, they're in research staff, they're in scientific center. And so really we need to talk about what is the future of those librarians. And finally, and this is one I think that we give away too easily, is what is the future of those librarians in a democracy? That we take on a really special role, and particularly, you know, this is symbolic, but you take on a very special role when you talk about your mission in terms of how do we impact an ongoing conversation. And I think all too often libraries, and once again, I think museum and archives probably are even more guilty of this, but that's an assumption from outside. We spend some time thinking, well, the world's out there and we're doing our thing. But we need to really worry at a profound sort of Shakespearean level. What is our influence on culture and society and information? And how can we affect a positive change? I often say that librarians don't have jobs, they have vocations. We sort of take on a mission to change the world. And I think we forget that when we look at our tools, which says, you know, this is how we change the world. It's not how we catalog this object. It's how this object is going to go out and influence the whole universe. So we have a question. So when we look at the future, I think a better question is what should be the future of libraries and librarians in democracy? But that question doesn't quite give us the way to answer it because we also need some guidance. When you look at the future and there's so many billions of different examples and ideas, which ones are you going to pick on? Which ones are you going to pick out? And so not only do you need the question, but you need sort of the way to start, the framework to take it. And so, for example, this is about the 1507, the image of the world. You can see we sort of knew that there was South America up there. We had an idea that there was a coast, but we had no idea what was behind it. Australia didn't really exist. So we could look at this and say this was wrong. But I bring this up because the analogy to me looking at what is the future of libraries is very much about naval navigation. And it goes like this. It used to be that when pre-Middle Ages, if you wanted to go anywhere on a boat, you got in the boat and you made sure that you could keep sight of the land. Because all the charts you had that says this is where you are were based on landmarks, meaning that as you went down the coast, you looked for that mountain ridge, you looked for that bay, you looked for that lighthouse, you looked for whatever. And if you ever lost sight of the ocean, if you ever lost sight of the coast, you were lost. You went literally off the side of the earth. And so navigation started with this idea of just being able to hug the coastline, and it really limited the amount of traffic, the amount of exploration, the routes that you could take. Now, what's interesting then is people began to think there's a better way. And they developed an idea of latitude, which was if you look at the stars, you can figure out what angle you are north and south on the earth. And so now what you could do is even though you couldn't know east or west, as you went down the coast, you could use sextants and star charts to begin to understand where you were north and south. The problem being then if you ever passed the equator, then you went off the side of the earth because all the stars were different and they had to do different charts. Now, I bring up this analogy because I think very much that libraries right now, when they look at their future, are in this mode, which is we look for landmarks and we look for near things. And those things, instead of being Colossus of Rhodes and these things, are, what's Google doing? Oh, look, it's Twitter. Oh, we look to the technology industry and say, that's a trend that we must adopt. Because they're like us. We're like Google. We're like Amazon. We're in the information business. So whatever they're doing, it must be like us. Right? So you've all been on the web committee. Right? It always starts with, our website is horrible. It must get better. Let's put together another committee. Right? And so you get together, and after you go through the 3 hours about how your mother couldn't find anything, and then you go to the fact that you don't like blue, and are we really stuck with the institutional logo, and how big does it have to be, somewhere someone will say, well, it needs to be simpler and easier. It needs to be like Google, or it needs to be like Amazon. And I would ask you, why? Well, it's simple and it's easy. And I say the question, well, is Google in the same business that you're in, the libraries? Well, they find information. I said, well, Google's not in the find information business. Google's in the advertising business. It's the largest advertiser in the world, and whatever they can do with their lost leaders like search, like blogging, like office applications, to get your eyeballs on ads, that's what they're going to do. And we've already seen that they can influence, for example. In fact, you really don't want to be like Google in your search algorithms, because then what you'd be doing is selling placement in the catalog to good authors, which, by the way, if you're willing to do it, I'm willing to pay. But... And Amazon. Well, Amazon's in the book business. Well, Amazon's in the thing business. If you've ever spent any time on Amazon, their book business is making money, but you can also buy a garden rake on Amazon, right? It's Walmart with a really cool logo that smiles at you. And I'm not sure we're in that same business. So we look at these near-term landmarks. But once again, getting back to my story, here we are. We're navigating up and down. It doesn't work. And the real problem is, once we figured out the star charts, we could figure out latitude north and south. But east and west, still a problem. I mean, it's really interesting. When you look at navigation at the time, people, what they would do is the captain would take out a big log, throw it in the water, and see how far it recedes in the distance, and guess how fast they were going, and come through this, like, three-hour calculation where the people in the crow's nest were literally burning their eyes out to figure out the sun's location, and they would end up a couple thousand miles in the wrong place on rocks and die. It was bad. Right? And so what happened was, in fact, it happened all over the world, but in Britain is one of the clearest examples. The Parliament passed something called the Longitude Act, which is they were going to give out a huge amount of money. I mean, we're talking in today's dollars, millions and millions of dollars, if anyone could figure out how to figure out east-west. And the big money was on astronomy, that people were going to be able to chart the star and the moon's location through the sextant they could figure it out. And they'd come up with some rough estimations. But there was this little craftsman who was working away, who was a clockmaker. And he decided that the real way to do this was to build a better clock. The problem with clocks at the time is that they were pendulum clocks. And when you're on the ocean and your boat's doing this and your pendulum's doing this, it doesn't keep good time. And if you went to a spring-loaded system and you moved into the tropics and into the Arctic, the springs froze and contracted different time. They lost things like hours a day. It wasn't a good thing. But he developed, through a whole series of technology, a really cool set of clock mechanisms, and won this money, that allowed them to figure out, as they moved east and west, they could look at the sun's location, look at the time on their clock, know what the time was back in Greenwich, and could calculate the difference in around a circle, and that's how far they were. And it massively revolutionized seafaring. First of all, it opened up colonization like crazy. It created cross-ocean systems of commerce. It allowed the colonization of many different places, good or bad or indifferent. And suddenly the ocean was open to us. And what's interesting is we've ended up with a system of navigation that looks like this. Now, what's interesting about this system of navigation, and you can see the checker mark, those are longitude and latitude lines. And we've sort of come to know them and live with them and understand them. And what's interesting is with GPS, which got me here yesterday, it still uses the stars, except they're satellites, and it still uses time differentials to figure it out. It's the same concept we use to navigate around Washington, D.C., is the same concept they invented to go across the oceans. But what I want to point out about these lines is they don't exist. You don't trip over them as you go. Right? It's not like you're in the equator, you're lost, you're going through a South American jungle, and this big red line pops out, and you go, aha, we found the equator. If we just sort of walk across this, we'll end up in Asia soon. Right? It's a concept. It's artificial. It doesn't exist. In fact, it not only doesn't exist, It's actually a human construct that shows human frailties. What do I mean? If you grew up, if you know this map, it's probably like me. This was in the classroom when you were growing up, and this was the Earth. Right? This is what the Earth looks like. Right? We know. We've gone to space. This is what it looks like. Look at Greenland. Greenland's really, really big, but it's not. What you're seeing is you're seeing a two-dimensional projection from a three-dimensional object. I want to show you the fact that if you grew up as a school kid in Australia, this is the map that you grew up with. Now, a couple things to notice. First of all, this is not upside down. Notice all the words you can read. Because Australia said, what's this about north being up? I don't think so. Right? And so just because you live in Alaska doesn't mean that you aren't on diplomatic relationships with Santa Claus. It's important where we are in the world. Sorry, bad attempt at a political joke. Anyway, the other thing I want you to notice about this is it's the same map, it's the same projection, but look how small the United States is compared to Australia. It's a different projection. Look at, you can barely see Greenland over in that itty-bitty corner. Right? These constructs are constructs. This way we interpret and represent reality are created through a social process. But this intellectual construct of longitude and latitude allowed them to truly navigate and understand the world. And I would argue it also bounded the world. Meaning these constructs that we make up are really the limits of our possibilities. It's not that there's some physical nature limiting that. It's how well we conceptualize the world. And by moving away from these near-Earth landmarks, by moving away from having to hug close to the coastline, you open up an entire new world of possibilities. You open up the ability to go to whole new places you were never able to go before. So when I talk to a library director and they talk about the future, they talk about preserving the investment in metadata. Preserving the investment in metadata. Meaning, we spent a lot of money to catalog these books. By God, we're going to find a use for a catalog. And I think this is problematic because it doesn't represent a deeper view of the world, and it doesn't talk about how what happens if you leave the catalog. When you ask the question, what's a library without a catalog? If you don't have a deeper conceptual framework, it's an absurd question, and it's a scary question. If, on the other hand, you say, the reason that the catalog's just another database from all is because we understand that we're really in X business, Y business, Z business. Right? So what we have, then, is a conceptual framework that allows us to learn from the past, maneuver in the present, and then create the future. And I want to show you, then, if you take these concepts, this perspective, and you apply it to different things, you get different results. So luckily, a lot of these previous speakers were online, so I can steal all their best stuff. And this Roy Tennant was up here, and he talked about the history. Right? It's pretty natural that when you talk about the future, you always end up talking about the past. Right? Yeah, I mean, that can be annoying, too. Have you ever been in the committee meeting with the historian? And you guys have been in the meetings with historians. But I met the person who goes, well, what you got to remember is in 1932, we tried blogging, and it didn't work. And you want to say, in 1932, you tried blogging? Yeah, we did on slate tablets, and we hung it outside the door and let anyone write on them. So we got to be careful. But this notion of looking at history. So Roy looked at the history. And I want to pull out a little bit of this history, because while I think a lot of what I say is complementary and goes together, I disagree with him on a few points. So when he talked about the history, he started at the Library of Alexandria and talked about the collection and how horrible it was to cultural history with the destruction of the collection. He then talked about the notion of knowledge becoming more replicable, disseminatable through the scriptoriums and how the monks would copy things, and so we didn't have to worry about one item. And he went on to printing presses and amplification of that. And then he talked about how Benjamin Franklin really constructed some of the underpinnings of today's public libraries with the notion of sharing knowledge, sharing collections. That there were all these sort of, frankly, rich white men in Pennsylvania that had big books and ran out of room, and so let's all put them together. So let me take a little different view of history here, right? Instead of Library of Alexandria started our foundational thoughts about libraries as a big collection and gathering the world's knowledge together in a place, to taking knowledge and making it replicable, to then taking knowledge and making it shareable. I want to take you a different perspective. I'm going to start with the Library of Alexandria. But what you need to realize about the Library of Alexandria is it wasn't a building. In fact, many people call the Library of Alexandria a collection. It was a campus. And in fact, the library was built next to this big building dedicated to the worship of the muses, and it was called a musée, where we get museum. And what's interesting is when you look at the functions of these two buildings, they're radically different, right? So yes, the Alexandrians loved documents and they loved information. So in fact, if a ship came into the harbor, what they would do is they would send someone down to confiscate all of their scrolls. And I think in a brilliant way, they would then take those scrolls, copy them, and hand the copies back to the ship. You know, if we could do that. I notice you're doing bag checks. Maybe this is a good idea. And so they would take these documents, but they wouldn't take them back and put them in the library. They would take these documents and they would put them in the museum. Because what the library was for was scholarship. So what the other thing the Library of Alexandria is doing is they were bringing scholars from all over the known world, setting them up with patronage accounts, and bringing them to walk around this building they called the library. And when they constructed it with open courtyards, they constructed it with places to walk, they built the different housing, the housing in the system so that the scholars would have to bump into each other on a regular basis. And then as they were doing their scholarship and learning, they would begin to write things down, and what would happen after they wrote them down is they would go to the museum. And so what happened was, if you think about the Library of Alexandria, it wasn't a place with a lot of stuff. It was a place of creation that turned into a lot of stuff, was inspired by stuff, but it was a point of creation. It was a point of scholarship and knowledge. Now, then he goes into the notion of destruction. In the Middle Age, we kept knowledge alive through the scriptorium, but that's not in fact true. That if you look at it, what happened was, the Western Europe went into this horrible dark ages and bad things happened and they lived in reverse, which is the glory days were behind them. And so and the other thing that happened is mercenaries started popping up and fighting each other. And so the Pope, to get rid of them, said, oh, crusade, go save Moorish Spain from those horrible Islamists out there. And so more or less the mercenaries, half of which were Muslim, went in, shook hands and traded Toledo for them. And when the Western Europe took Moorish Spain, what they found were libraries, thousands and thousands of volumes. In fact, so many volumes that they had to take them and translate them. And this massive infusion of information went into Western Europe, where they began to study them and they created the first universities to literally look at translations of this document. Now, you can say, Dave, this is documents. But the truth is, what they also found in Moorish Spain is that people were actually reading them, that people were using Greek thought, that people were using Greek architecture and geography and geology and geometry to figure out how to build vibrant communities. And this information from attacks moved way into Western Europe and brought us out of the Dark Ages. And then, jumping a few steps, while Benjamin Franklin built one of the first libraries in Philadelphia, it was not the first public library in Philadelphia. It was a for-fee member library. This is a fellow by the name of Pepper. Pepper was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He got a rich uncle to endow the creation of the first public library in Philadelphia. And when he created it for knowledge for all. It was no longer subscription-based. Now, what I want to highlight in this is a move from collection to scholarship, an interpretation of the Library of Alexandria not as a bunch of stuff, but as an activity. It was much more of a university than it was of a collection. The move from dissemination to action. Those items in the monks were copying went into these monasteries that no one was allowed into. The libraries in Toledo and in Spain were open for all the people to come read and understand new knowledge. The move from sharing to a social good. What Benjamin Franklin was talking about with libraries was, let's get together and pool our resources. What Pepper was talking is, let's radicalize the citizens of Philadelphia to be better. And really, the overall is moving as knowledge as thing versus knowledge as action. And I want to hold on to that knowledge as action for a moment. And I just want to demonstrate it. This is a page from the Gutenberg Bible. And when you look at the Gutenberg Bible, some people look at it as an origin of printing. Oh, this is when the press and movable type started. Some people look at this as, rightly so, an artifact to be preserved. Oh, I've got to worry about this acidity and this humidity, and I've got to worry about these things. And some people look at this as a religious truth. When some people look at the Gutenberg Bible, they say, this is the Word of God. This is how it's done. Now, none of those people are wrong. And that object didn't change throughout it. But I would argue that the mission of the library is out there Not in there, necessarily. You need that. It's important. But it's the conversations and interpretation of what's going on that really talks about knowledge as action. When people look at these things, right? So I mean, we're in the Smithsonian. I love the Smithsonian, right? It's sort of, I don't know if I'm speaking heretically to walk into the Smithsonian and say that artifacts are secondary to this, but I don't think so. Because the idea is that if we closed all the doors, the Smithsonian's not useful, right? If we restrict hours to 15 minutes every third Thursday of November, it loses its value. And it's not because the stuff changed. It's because of access and action and understanding changed, right? The user defines the context, not the object or the facilitator. Now, those of you who are in the cataloging business will instantly say, wait a minute, this is pretty cool, because in the 30s, we used to think we could take a book and bring the metadata out of the book. It was like this voodoo activity where we just sort of, there's a title, I feel an author coming on, right? And we realize, you know, and look, Library of Congress, right? This idea that somehow the information was inherent in it, we've realized for a long time that we're interpreting. Someone once described cataloging a book as a pre-reference interview. The idea that we're sort of guessing how people are going to look for this thing. And it's an interpretation and understanding. I talked at the Catholic University up here, and I was talking to their new dean, and she was saying how she was talking to, see, a lot of talking to, people in the Delaware County Technical Services area, and they were saying that the problem with the curriculum, problem with students, is that we teach library students cataloging to the thing. And we need to realize that cataloging is part of a larger conversation. Where did these subject headings come from? What does it mean? How do we understand it? What's the term of art? This is a community activity of which they're the last part in adding the metadata. Now, I said knowledge is thing versus knowledge is action. How this becomes directly relevant is when I look at, I don't know, a mission statement that's on a website and I read it. You can read this mission statement radically different if you take those two perspectives. I then bequeath my whole of my property to the United States of America for the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Does that mean for the increase and diffusion of stuff, or does that mean for the increase and diffusion of action, of changing life? That's how important that distinction is between if you look at a book and say that book is knowledge, or if you say reading that book is knowledge. That's how big a distinction we're talking about. Now, I've been talking about knowledge and I've been talking about conversation, so let me make my terms very clear. Participatory librarianship that we've been spending some time on comes from a very simple notion, which is knowledge is created through conversation. I'm going to talk about what that word conversation is in a minute. That when we seek to understand, when we seek to know, when we seek to make sense of the world, the way we do it is we reach out and we have conversations. Sometimes those conversations are one-on-one. Sometimes they're one-to-many. Sometimes they're many-to-many. Sometimes they're within ourselves. Now, that may sound original or it may sound weird. People in libraries particularly are worried about people who talk to themselves in front of reference desks. But really what it means is when you woke up this morning and you said, you know, am I going to wear this jacket or this tie, who were you talking to? When you're sitting there right now going, is this ever going to end? Who are you talking to? Right? That's a conversation you're having with yourself. Now, we can call that metacognition if we want it, or critical thinking. But the point of it is that we're having a conversation. And I'm going to talk a little bit more. If libraries are in the knowledge business, and I have very few people go up and say, no, we're in the stuff business. We're in the book warehousing business. We're in the materials distribution business. If we're in the knowledge business, we are therefore in the conversation business. And it changes everything. So what do I mean by conversation? It comes from this fellow by the name of Gordon Pask. Gordon Pask was a cybernetician who wanted to teach machines how to think. And he thought until they caught up, he'd use people instead. And so he looked at how people thought. And that's where he came up with this knowledge is created through conversation. And he said, this is what conversation is, because it's not a metaphor. When we put this out, some people go, oh, that's storytelling. It's literally conversation. What is a conversation? First of all, it's a set of two or more conversants. We talked about how those conversants can be multiple people. It can be one-to-one. It can be within one's individual. And what are those conversants doing? They're exchanging language back and forth. So that's what we're doing. Now, it's very interesting when you look at language. It's not just a matter of a bunch of utterances going back and forth. They have levels. So level one, what he called L0, means I don't know whatever you're talking about, so take it simple with me, please. Right? So L0 is directional. Have you ever been to really bad computer training where they say things like, click here, now click here, now click here. And in the middle of it, you go, now why? Don't ask. Click here. Now why? Click here, click here. And you're writing it down. And you walk away knowing what to click, but no idea why or how it works. And you don't truly understand the system. That's an L0 conversation. When you go into a new setting, you know nothing about a topic, and you start asking things like, well, you know, we were just having a conversation about Smithsonian Libraries. How many libraries do you have? How is it organized? It's very directional. It's a simplistic language because we don't understand the domain. That eventually migrates up to what he would call L1 language, where both of the conversants understand what they're talking about. Now, that's, for example, I can say the word catalog, and you don't think JCPenney's, right? I can say catalog, and you don't think sweater, right? That's where having an L1 conversation. Now, what's interesting is look at the systems we build and ask yourself, are they L0, L1? Or what really PASC was trying to get is learning systems that bring people from low knowledge to high knowledge to train them. The number one L0 interface, meaning not a lot of knowledge in use in the world today, is probably Google. Look at Google, that one little text box that we all love. That one little text box we all love allows an L0 conversation, which is, Google doesn't tell you how to get better at searching. You go in and you put in a query, education, it throws you a bunch of stuff back. This is why, by the way, I hate the idea of librarians saying that they are really good search engines, because you're not. And it's not that you're bad at searching. It's by, do you really want to compete with something that hands back a million pieces of crap in less than 3 microsystems? That's not the competition you want to have, right? So we have these different language conversations. And so your catalogs tend to be L0 and L1. Now, what's interesting is if you look at evaluation of catalog usage, information seeking, librarians rock the catalog. They're brilliant at it. They can manipulate it. They can use it like crazy because they understand the domain. They're having, in essence, an L1 conversations with catalogs. Our patrons have no such luck. And so that's why catalogs aren't terribly effective. Google, same thing. Did you realize that within that nice little Google box, you can basically do a dialogue query back to the 70s, right? That we can do tildes and quotes and ands and approximate searching and all that stuff. If you know what's going on, you can work it in a very sophisticated way. But it doesn't take you from one point to another. By the way, one of the best systems that educate people are games. Used to be that when you'd buy games, they would come with manuals that were that thick about what you did if you hit F5 to roll out of the way and not get shot. Now, it has a little itty-bitty paper manual, and the first level of the game is sort of teaching you what happens, and they try to integrate into the narrative and storytelling. So, something to think about. Now, what are we doing? These conversants are passing language and back and forth. To what end? To what end is they are seeking agreements? They want to come to an understanding. Right? So, does that make sense? You know, is that all right? Yeah, these kinds of confirmatory things are what we're trying to do. Oh, you mean, no, I meant, oh, you mean, okay, that's so therefore we mean. And we come up to agreements. But you see it in daily talk, but you also see institution to institution. When you sign that vendor agreement, that contract is a concrete representation of an agreement that through conversation between the institutions you had come to, and you codify it. Those agreements then get stored into a memory. And memory is vital here. There's 2 things that are very important about memory. One, you need one. And 2, that memory is not simply a set of buckets that we deposit stuff into. Memory is a set of relations of agreements. Once you make an agreement, you relate it to another, you relate it to another, you relate it to another. So I'll give you a very simple example. If I say the word light, right? Think about what I mean by the word light. Now, this is the interactive portion of our day. How many people thought not heavy? How many people thought illumination? How many people thought set on fire? That's good. Good. No pirate. But what's interesting is they all work, right? When I said light, you were like, oh, I didn't think about that. But yeah, that's fine, right? It makes sense to us. But if I say the word formula, how many people think chemical combination? How many people think mathematical construct? How many people think, would I give a baby to keep it from starving? Right? Okay. They all make sense. But actually, the last one's kind of funny because you go, well, yeah, it does make sense, but I didn't think about that. Right? We relate these terms. Now, one last term. OMG. I'm going to guess, not even sure, that you probably didn't think Omni Media Group. Right? You probably thought, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Right? And I could even ask, what technology does OMG bring up in your head? Texting. Right? Period. The thing is, you've related it, but it's so few contexts in which you encounter OMG that you create a very strong bond to one technology. Light, formula. We hit those all the time. The point is that your brain is relating these things together. And it doesn't just relate words together that are often socially defined. They begin to relate other things together and larger concepts together. So when I'm in a library group and I say things like women in comfortable shoes, does Nike jump up into your mind? Right? Because you have a context in which you have a relationship. Your brain doesn't work by itty bitty bits of buckets. Right? So you add this notion of what a conversation is, and it creates a very interesting thing. If we learn through conversation, if we create knowledge through conversation, and we then go to a system where we seek to learn, we want to engage in conversation. We seek out tools to engage in conversation. And so what this creates is a pressure for participation. When I am in a context of learning, whether it's informal, formal, I don't care. I want to be part of it. I want to have a part of that conversation. People need to actively construct their knowledge. Therefore, they want tools that allow and facilitate the conversation application. So when they show up at your libraries, at your archives, at your museums, and they're seeking to learn, and they want to be part of that, and they want to actively construct it, how many times do we simply put that piece of plexiglass, metaphorically or physically, between us and it, and say, consume? We sort of assume that we have a consumer population that we can dump information into. When you go into a library catalog and you put into a query, what does it do? It spits back a bunch of materials. Can the person then resort, rejigger, create, move over, comment upon, add, edit, change, conversation, participate? Or no. That's the role of the library. That's the role of other people. So this notion, you'll notice I don't spend a lot of time in technology, but this whole idea of Web 2.0, this concept isn't a Web 2.0 concept. It's a human concept. It's what we do in daily life on a regular basis. We were talking about part of the audience problem today is the fact that there's this little thing going on called an election. And people believe in it and want to be part of the conversation, and that means they engage, they become civically engaged, they participate in our regular life. This isn't just a digital thing. It's not something the internet created. I think a lot of the problem when people look at Web 2.0 and those near coastal technologies is they say, oh, that's brand new. Somehow the internet has created a new phenomenon that we can capture, and it's bogus. It's amplified it. It's made it a greater scale, but it is fundamentally a human process that we need to capture. And that's very different than the idea of, oh, it's this function. And that's why when we do things like randomly throw tagging and lists and visualizers at systems like catalogs that aren't about conversation, no one uses them. Because they look at it and they say, this is great. Tagging. Library thing is a site where you can go create your own, sort of use it as your own personal catalog. You put up your books and you can tag it, see other people, share the books. It becomes a very social experience. In tagging, you can add uncontrolled keywords to a bunch of these materials, and it's rampant in library things. People do it all the time. And they were trying to wonder, because Amazon provides the same capability. And in Amazon, no one tags. And the head of library thing was musing in his blog about why this happened, and he said, it's the idea that in library thing, you're tagging your own stuff. And in Amazon, they're inviting you in to organize their shelves. And I think that notion of ownership, of participation, of learning knowledge, it's not that people want to just, it's vanity and they just want to be seen, look at me, look at me. It's a matter of them creating their own world around them. We can see this in systems like MySpace, versus GeoCities. That itty-bitty line down there is GeoCities. That line is MySpace. This is old data as of 2006, I believe. What is going on here? Because both of them allow you to create your own personal space on the web. Both of them allow you to share documents and materials. Why is one going crazy and the other not? Because GeoCities walks you through a series. Pick a template, do this, it will look like this, here are rules and regs, go. MySpace says, you want an ugly background? Enjoy. You want to put a picture of you half naked so you can get a job later? We don't care. Right? MySpace, in essence, allows people to construct the worlds around them, even if the worlds they're building aren't necessarily that good. Right? But that's the difference. It's not, one's cheaper than the other. It's not one. GeoCities was first. This whole first mover principle doesn't apply here. It's, I can control and build the world around me. I can have a conversation with my friends. They can post stuff on my material. We see this again in the famous Wikipedia example. Wikipedia versus Encarta. Both free. Both access. Why is one going the other? Oh, it's just good enough information. People don't care about good stuff. Equally available. It's not just good enough information. It's the fact that when I get to Wikipedia, I can see the dialogue. There's a huge amount of dialogue, discussion, politics, gender, power, race, everything going into Encarta, but it's all hidden. The conversation's made front and center in Wikipedia. And you can increase the scope, and if there's something you care about, you can be the expert. How many people on a regular basis check the Doppler radar on your local site? You know, you're going to go out, you want to know if it's right. Oh, come on. Yeah. Are you meteorologists? Do you truly understand the Doppler effect and how the amplitude of the wave shifts over time? No, but what we've done is we've become experts. It's accessible to us enough, and every night we have a weatherman who, one, predicts the weather wrong, and two, teaches us to be meteorologists, and so now we feel comfortable taking that data in and of itself. We feel that we can become the experts and take those tools on. We can build the world around us. We don't have to wait for someone else to present the built world. Now, what's interesting is, once again, this may seem contradictory to the notion of, I don't know, curators and experts. It's not. People love curation because it represents a voice. The people in Multnomah County Public Library in Portland asked teenagers what they wanted on the library website. Their number one request was blogs. And it wasn't blogs for the teenagers. They wanted their librarians to blog. And the librarians looked and said, why? You want to hear about, you know, the toner cartridges and things? No, they wanted reader's advisory. But they didn't want just a list of good books. They wanted to know who you were to find out if the book list of books was any good. They wanted a voice. Right? When you talk about credibility, credibility is created in the mind of the person perceiving the information, not in the transmitter or object of the information. People see things. This is why we have Fox News, right? When I sit in front of Fox News, I get angry. When my stepfather sits in front of Fox News, he loves it because there's a recognizable voice that people can determine whether it's credible or not. Two major criteria for credibility on a website. Number one, is it pretty? Number two, do I already agree with it? If you can factor in those two variables, you can determine whether people are going to see it, whether it's, right? If it's pretty, that means it's professional, that means it's organizational, that's institutional, therefore it's good. Right? Very interesting. We like to think about the notion of .gov somehow has some weight of credibility to it, but to many people, they see a .gov, they take it the opposite way and assume it's biased information. That point of view is important. And so when you look at curation in museums, I think we need to do a lot more curation in libraries. But it doesn't mean just selection. I think a lot of librarians, when they hear curation, they mean, you mean filter and break things down? I said, no, it means adding voice to. It means making that voice present so that people can build their world around them. Now, the other thing that becomes important in this model of knowledge is that we need to be in the facilitation business, not the access business. So the example I give is that's my son over in the little corner reaching out for George Washington's sword. What happens if he gets it? Well, yeah, you guys get ticked. But the truth is, it's not like he's going to take it home, right? It's not like he knows what to do with it. It's not that he even understands the power of it. I think sometimes in the world we spend way too much time on access. Access is not knowledge. Access is not equal knowledge. Access doesn't even necessarily lead to knowledge. Access simply means you get to a point of conversation, right? So the example of reading. I loved it. In the mid-90s in education, people were talking about technology is great because technology allows, you know, new stuff and whatever, and we needed to provide access to technology. But the truth is that once people got the computers, they realized that the kids and the teachers didn't know how to use them, and they were useless. And so people quickly learned that the digital divide wasn't about a technology question, it was about a training question. Right? So true facilitation of knowledge, true creation of knowledge through conversation, involves access. Can I get to the conversation? Do I have to come to Washington to be part of this, or can I see a scanned version of it online? Right? That's the real digitization question in many camps, where you digitize for access. And that's fine. But the other part is knowledge, which is once I get to the conversation, do I understand what's going on? Is it in English because I don't speak Spanish? Is it in Spanish and I don't speak it? You know, what's the language that's going on? What's the history? How many people have joined the committee that's existed for 1932 and they're all still on it and you show up and everything you say, you're trying to learn it new? Or worse, you show up to the committee and you have the same meeting you had last year and the meeting before that, because there's no history to it, right? We need knowledge to understand it, right? So we offer education programs. That catalog I mentioned, that L0 catalog, we offer library and bibliographic instruction to try and raise people's rates. We understand this. But what's interesting is instead of seeing that training as fundamental to what we do, we see it as only helping people to get to what we really do, which is access. And that's not the case. The other side is a safe environment to do it in. All right, so I'm at the conversation. I can understand what's going on, but I'm not going to say a word because I don't know who these people are. Oh, the director's in the room, and I don't want to be seen as off base. Right? How many times have you had to go into a meeting and basically say, it's okay to ask a question? It's okay not to know the answer. What you're giving is a safe environment to do that in. We do that with intellectual privacy, intellectual property policies. We do that by putting guards at the end so that when they come into our physical spaces, people feel safe. We have fundamental principles in library science around intellectual freedom. Those are value-based environmental safety. Right? That's all about providing an environment. So I'm at the conversation. I know what's going on. I feel safe to contribute. But is there any reason I should? Do I care? Right? And this happened, for example, in the big digital library, brouhaha. I was part of the fun digital libraries. And digital libraries, we build these fascinating, beautiful collections of Confucian texts and such. And we'd invite the teachers in because now they had access to the good information. And we would wonder why they didn't stick around. They would come in and they would find the images and they put the lesson plan, but they wouldn't give us the lesson plan back. We put a comment form in and no one would fill it out. What's going on here? And then we look at Flickr. Damn it. And everyone was uploading their images just fine there. They didn't care to give it to us, but Flickr, they'll do it fine. And we were like incensed. And the answer we came up with was good enough. Well, they're just going to, it's good enough there. They don't quite need the Confucian text, so they just go to Wikipedia and look up the word Confucius. I mean, the idea was that we didn't give them an opportunity to participate. We didn't give the tools to craft the world around them. We said we invited them into our space to give them our information for us. And people said, forget it. And the other thing is they said, what's in it for me? And some of it's vanity. Look, your name's up there. Look, this is up there. But a lot of it is extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. How do we reward people? So I talk about identity management in libraries, and there are two identities in any library. We're very naive on this. There are librarians and there are not librarians. Right? Not librarians consist of everything from the President of the United States down to the person who locks up the door at night. Why? Because if the President of the United States, well, let's choose a little less charged one. The director of the Smithsonian walks in and they want to change or add something to a library record, what do they have to do? Find a librarian. We're gatekeepers. We say the people who are able to author in this environment and in our systems are librarians, and the people who are not able to author are not librarians. Annotations, tagging, these are nice little baby steps to distributing identity. Why is it that if someone knows a lot more about us, they can't go in and edit the record? Why can't we have our curators adding annotations and records and materials? Maybe you are. I hope so. So we need to worry about motivation. So Eli Nyberg at the Ann Arbor Public Library talks about how the library went from a net detractor of social capital to a net creator of social capital. It used to be that teenage boys never wanted to go in the library. They didn't want to be seen in the library because that meant they were nerds. Geeks good, nerds bad. Nerds, right? But then they started offering gaming programs, and the first thing they did with these gaming tournaments is they put their scores online. And now what happens is these kids were dragging their friends to the library website to show them how good they were. Now what the library was doing was actually providing them social capital, which motivated them to come to the library and be part of the library because it recognized their own reward system. So, all right. We have our question. What should the future of libraries and librarians be in a democracy? We have our framework, this notion of knowledge is created through conversation. Now we can look at the future. And the guy in the middle there is to warn us that any glance at the future is ultimately flawed. This is in the 30s, and most of the future was about the fact that men would someday wear beards. So, hey, it came true. And I had that hat. No. The other thing before I go too far into this is that I want to make clear that this is an agenda, not prediction. I don't know if this stuff's going to happen, but this is the stuff that I think we, and I know I, should work really hard at making happen. Right? So when we talk about, I love the idea of strategic plan, because it means we're planning for, we're thinking about. So when we look at the future, there are those who look at the trends and say, this plus this equals this. And I say, this plus this equals whatever we want it to be. And you go, oh, you can't fight the trends. But the truth is that the trends, you don't know if you're measuring the right thing to begin with, so you better set out what your ideal future is and work towards it. All right. So a simple idea that leads to something that I call the Dewey level shift, right? This notion of knowledge is created through conversation seems simple. Okay, fine, Dave. We'll have more speaker series in the library and be done with it. Okay, Dave, we'll allow tagging, and that means we'll be modern. But I would tell you that that's not true. That when you follow this concept through, you end up with radical shifts. And shifts that I would propose to you are as radical in the library profession as Dewey's effect was on the library profession. And I don't mean the decimal system. That was only one small part of Dewey's impact. Melville Dewey, you know, semi-balding guy with a beard from upstate New York who was a professor. Dewey 2.0. Melville Dewey, not only, besides having slightly anti-Semitic tendencies, created an organizational structure. He created an education system within libraries. He created formalization. And he did something which I think has actually done us a disservice, but has dominates libraries today, which is he put the focus on librarianship on efficiency and cooperation. If you look at what Dewey was trying to do with the decimal system, it wasn't that he wanted to organize the world better. He wanted a standard way to organize the world. He wanted to bring a common perspective. And so when I hear about these great things that say we walk into a group of new people who are working together, and the first thing, this is the Revenge of the Librarians meeting for a moment. Revenge of the Librarians goes like this. The first meeting is between, and I'm going to randomly pick things, and I have no idea what I'm saying, the Natural History Museum and the National Museum of American Art. And they get together in the meeting, and they say, we should collaborate on these projects. Yes, we should share our data. Yes. Second meeting. Oh, we should really share documents together through a system. Yeah. Has anyone ever done this before? Third meeting, they invite the librarian. The librarians, I used to think this was great, that the librarians would walk in and say, okay, what we need is an ontology to organize your information. We need to come up with common terminology and a metadata scheme. We're going to use Dublin Core, because there are a lot of Dublin Core-like tools, and then we're going to be using an API interface. And I thought, this was great. We're bringing all our years of history in and helping these people communicate. And what finally dawned on me is what we were, they were never invited to the fourth meeting. Because what we did is, that old phrase that to a hammer, everything's a nail. We would walk in with about 3,000 years of history, right? We weren't the world's oldest profession, but we probably helped organize the records of the first. And we would instantly try and take them to a place they weren't ready to go. They were busy having a conversation and seeking agreement, and what we were trying to do was say, agree on this, agree on that, agree on this, agree on that, and they weren't ready. They didn't necessarily trust each other yet. They didn't necessarily understand the domain around the world. They didn't have a process in place. They didn't have a comfort level. And what we were trying to do is to skip the conversation part and jump to the formalization process. And so I think that this notion of the Dewey level shift says facilitation. It's not about stuff. Stuff is, I call it the idea that artifacts are secondary objects. Let me be very clear before I get thrown out. That doesn't mean unimportant. That doesn't mean useless. That doesn't mean non-existent. That means secondary to the primary goal of knowledge creation. And knowledge creation is a uniquely human process, and it's a process that goes through conversation. So what's the primary object? Conversations. And when that turns into systems, it changes things pretty impressively. So let's go through a couple of these. What's the implication for the future of systems? First of all, we need to be building systems that are about discovery and not inventory. A library catalog today is an inventory system, period, nuff said, done. Now, if you don't know the difference between an inventory system and a discovery system, let me tell you. If you ever go shopping for shoes and you walk up to a person and you pick a shoe, I'm willing to bring props. And you say, do you have this in a size 12? What happens is the person will then go behind a counter, disappear, and work on a terminal that you can't see, and say, yes, or we have it at this store, or we have it at that store. What that person will not do is to turn that system around you and go, I don't know, find out. And what do we do? Here's our catalog. Go search our inventory systems. Inventory systems are by their nature obscure. The other problem with inventory systems is that they are great for finding stuff you know exists. That's what they're great. They're finding known items. They rock at finding known items. If you have no clue what you're looking for, good luck. Right? That's when we hope browsing picks up. That's when we hope other things. The other thing is that our systems aren't about knowledge. They're about stuff. So when we get an item, we catalog the item. So we were having a brief conversation beforehand. See, you got to be careful when you talk to me beforehand. And we were talking about shoes, right? And that several libraries may want to sort of build systems around shoes. And the question is, how do we describe? Is it one set? Do the laces a separate object? Right? And these all these questions about resolution, what schema do we use, what language? And I would argue it doesn't matter. And you're going, huh? Here's what matters. How are people using the shoes? They're not wearing them, so we know that's not one. But it may be who wore them. Right? And what do they relate those shoes to? So when I walk through a museum, I tend to be one of those people that does a museum in an hour, right? Which I understand most curators despise. I should be actually there for 12 hours reading everything. But I love to just sort of browse. I'm like, you know, a bovine nature of libraries. And what I'm doing is I'm connecting things from different libraries together. Right? So when I look at the American History Museum and I look at what they've done in computers, I relate that to Air and Space Museum in terms of space flight, and I relate space flight even to evolution that's going on in natural. That's my way of organizing the world. All right, so I can do this in 10 seconds. I can do it in a minute. One of my favorite historians is a fellow by the name of James Burke. He's a BBC reporter and does things called Connections, State of the Universe Change. This is my favorite example from his. And what I want to do is I want to relate to you the sort of relational view of history. He said that the U.S. North winning the Civil War, I'm sorry, the Union winning the U.S. Civil War led to the computer revolution. Right? And so here it goes. The North should have lost the Civil War because the common thinking at the time was that the more men you could muster to the battlefield, the greater chance of victory. The South had more men on their side. However, the North, by happenstance of geography, had greater industry, and so what they could do was to negate that factor by bringing more cannons and artillery to the field so they could blow up more people. And the problem with cannons and artillery is you can't just point at someone and pull the trigger and go bang, because what happens is they shoot in an arc called a ballistic arc. To calculate the distance under an arc, what you have to do is calculate the area under the arc, which is calculus. Not too many Union soldiers could do calculus on the fly in the field. And so what they did is when they manufactured the cannon, they would create tables. They would say this distance equals this angle, this distance equals this angle, and they provide the table with the cannons. The U.S. North won the Civil War based on the ability to better use artillery that then became the common thinking in military history and military strategy, which was greater artillery leads to greater victory. This happened in World War I and World War II. The problem in World War II is we were facing against the Germans. The Germans actually had a greater industrial capability to produce artillery than we did, led to an arms race where you're getting bigger and bigger and more cannons, and they had to produce more and more of these tables. They ran out of people to do them. They wanted an automated way to do it, and so they began to develop the digital computer. So they developed ENIAC as a digital computer that they powered with vacuum tubes. The problem with vacuum tubes is they're very fragile, and so when insects and dust goes in them, they break, and they were breaking down all the time. They needed a better way of doing it. They figured out through physics if you wafer silicon together, you can get something called a transistor. The great thing about a transistor is you can shrink it over and over and over and over and over again, and eventually you get hundreds, thousands, and millions on top of it, and those millions of fabrications led to the computer CPUs that sit in every computer today, and therefore the modern computer revolution. Therefore, the U.S. North winning the Civil War led to the modern computer revolution. Thank you very much. That's not linear. Right? That's not how the history books would say it. And in fact, if we got a book on artillery, Civil War, ballistics, computers, ENIAC, would we have put them anywhere near each other? And yet, for Burke, they were fundamentally the same thing. And what he wants is a catalog record where he can put that into the catalog. Leave a path, a breadcrumb trail, which is fairly idiosyncratic. Terribly unique to him, but maybe very useful to multiple people, so that if I happen into a book and it says, here's a book on military history, by the way, do you want to see how that happens chronologically? Do you want to see how that happens in different industry? Or would you like to follow James Burke's trail? Or would you like to follow Dave Lankus's trail? Or would you like to find someone else's trail? And then it doesn't matter how many shoes there are, it's how those shoes are in context. And it's the context that we should be describing, not the things. One of the real problems we have in integrated library systems is that our catalogs describe things, books. And Ferber doesn't solve this problem by saying works. Because what I want is to describe relationships. The true knowledge in any collection exists in the space between books. It exists in the space between catalog records. So we need to stop adding lipstick to a pig. Tagging does not equal innovation. Lists do not equal innovation. This idea that we're going to add lists to our integrated library systems and people will be happy. Try this experiment. Pick a random object out of your office. Write down 10 keywords that you would describe that object. Do two things. Take that list to your next door neighbor and ask what you were describing. See if they can figure it out. By the way, you can't use things like Pepsi can if you're describing a Pepsi can. Second thing is, in a year, bring that list out again and see if you can find out what you were describing. Because you don't build the connective tissue between them, they don't make much sense. This is why a long time ago libraries built pathfinders and subject guides and annotated bibliographies, because connective tissue is what's vitally important here. We need to stop having next generation catalog conversations and commit to this being the last generation of catalogs. Catalogs as inventory systems are fine. Freeze them. Done. Take all the money, effort, time that the entire industry from vendors to librarians are doing and have them start again. And what they can do is build these conversational systems and point to the catalog. So when I describe the slippers, I point to that item. It's fine, but I don't want to be limited to have to change that item's description to capture this information. It's time to replace them with real tools of discovery knowledge. So they need to look less like this and more like this. Right, so this is an academic system where what we do is we have reserves. And so the reserve system over there is teachers say, I want them to read these documents. And if I go to the electronic reserves at Syracuse University, it says, here's my teacher, it says, here are the documents. That's useless, because really what's interesting is if you linked it back to the syllabi, you would know the ordering of those documents. You would know how those documents relate to each other. You would know assignments. If you then added the assignments, you would see how that knowledge was used and interested. And then you could make it available to other people to follow that track. So, for example, you could have a book in an anthropology course. And someone could be describing and talking about the notes of an anthropology course. This is what I thought about it. Who else had notes on this book? And you begin going and finding out that this book was also used in an information science course. Well, that's weird. I never thought about information. And suddenly you're building these connections across silos. I love the idea of interdisciplinary efforts, and librarians and libraries should be in the middle of those. Instead of having virtual reference systems that look like this, which is a template taken from the 1990s from a commercial help desk system called eGain, they should begin to look more like this, where what happens is objects are being pulled together and related to each other while conversation is going on along the end. Once again, there's links here to more information on that. When we look at the future of services in libraries, we need to talk about proactive service from librarians with strong identities, in-your-face librarianship. I think way too often we have taken service to mean transparent. We have taken service to mean passive. We have taken service to be servant. And we need to get rid of that right now. To be of service means to make things right, and oftentimes that requires a loud voice in doing it. We need to have people understand the value of what we do so that they will then provide the resources necessary to do it better. We need to understand that libraries are about enabling and empowering and co-owned with communities and not simply waiting passively for them. We need to talk about them distributed throughout the organization, that the library is at the point of conversation, not dragging the conversation to the library. We need to, so for example, pick on the U.S. Department of Justice law libraries, which have the most amazing librarians ever. And what they were realizing was that they were having a lot of lawyers do a lot of scut work that they could do better. Right? We've all had that situation, right? Where someone walks into you after 12 hours of frustration, you go, click, 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 here you go. You should have come to me 12 hours ago. But they realized that's probably not the way to do it. The number one thing that lawyers were doing and paralegals were doing was research on expert witnesses. So I have Dave's going to come up, tell me everything that Dave has ever written so that I can contradict his statements and I can basically discredit him, which was nice. And so the librarians realizing this realized that the way to do it wasn't to offer a course in how to do LexisNexis searching or how to do some library-centric view. They put out a class that said, Thursday, 2 o'clock, Character Assassination 101. And they brought lawyers in, and they geared their entire service around the sense of expert witnesses because it was a lever. And now what's interesting is you talk to their lawyers, and their lawyers talk about their librarians being part of the staff of that case. They talk about them being investigators, civil investigators for them, right? If you're in the criminal side, you can call up the FBI to go rough someone up, right? In the environmental law, you can't do that. So what they are doing is they're calling up librarians, not necessarily to have them rough them up, but I think that would be cool if we got badges and guns. That they actually call them on the librarians to make them part of, tell me about this, what's going on, what's happening. And they're part of these task-oriented teams. That when we look at things, so this was a business collection, for example, and the notion that the Free Library of Philadelphia I was working with wanted to build a more interesting and useful area of business, and they had a business collection. And so we went out to businessmen and we said, how can the library be of more use to you? And the businessmen said, you can't. We don't need you. The businessmen said, I work at Pfizer Pharmaceutical. We have a library. Thank you very much. But then what's interesting is almost every CEO and venture capitalist you talked to said, I don't need you now. But it was vital for you to be there when I started the business. I needed to find out what a business plan is. I needed to do competitive intelligence. And I couldn't do that in my own library because that's not cool. But I went to the library to do it. But they said the trick is, when I walk in, I don't just need a book. I need a course. I don't even know what I need to know. Right? It's like that access problem, right? My son gets a hold of the sword. He has no idea what he's going to do with it next. Right? So you go in and I want to start a business. And the reference librarian says, here's a book. I don't even know how to interpret this thing. So what they said is, we think that your business collection needs to look more like this. That when I come in as an entrepreneur, I need to know you need to put together a business plan. Here's a course on how to do it. You now need access to lawyers. We'll be having a lawyer come next Thursday night. You now need access to venture capital. We have a pitch session every third Friday. You now need a place where you can go do this because your home's too crowded. We have daycare for single mothers to do it. The idea of constructing services around the needs and conversation of the community, not about the artifacts of that community. Music collection, same thing. We talked to musicians. We said, what do you need? They said, you got plenty of CDs. Frankly, we don't even need the CDs anymore. What we really want are two grand pianos on a stage. Because in Philadelphia, there aren't enough places to perform the music. And the other problem is that I can't make a living as a classical music composer anymore. We talk about the endangered publishing model of popular music. Talk about a non-existent publishing model in classical music. There's no publisher to buy the scores. So they said is, we need a place to perform it. If we come perform it, you can record it and make that part of your collection. And over time, the music collection looks more like Philadelphia than everything but Philadelphia. When we talk about the future of governance, the governance is the idea of being collaborative, co-owned. If you're a library that wants to get more participation from teenagers, how many teenagers do you have on your board? And if you can't trust them to be on your board with governance, why should they trust you? Right? How many times do we talk about having liaisons, subject liaisons out of the library? How many subject liaisons do you have into the library on a regular basis? We need to be problem-based. Now, this is fluid and continuous, not teams and committees. Committees are, we look at ourselves, we break everything down into this nice bureaucratic structure, and we assign people to committees. Problem-based is, what do we want to accomplish? The team comes together for the point of duration and disappears. And what the manager's job is also facilitation, listening and going from meeting to meeting to communicate and disbanding meetings on a regular basis. There's no committee. Everything's a task force. There's no hierarchical structure. All goes away. We use wikis and blogs, not because they're cool and nifty, but because we can continuously update them and make them available. The cool thing about wikis and blogs for management are things called RSS feeds, feed readers where I can go through hundreds of news postings and announcements in minutes. The collection. The collection needs to be a picture of the organization, not a picture of the consumption of the organization. So academic libraries are finding this on a regular basis. It used to be that if I was writing an article and I needed a book, I went to the library and said, buy this book. And over time, what that meant was the library was filled with everything that the organization didn't have. And so it became a wonderful reflection of what my faculty consumed, but nothing about what my faculty produced. And we started talking about things like institutional repositories. The problem with institutional repositories is we assumed that academic output was exactly the same as every other type of output, so we put them in nice little containers with Dublin Core boxes, and people looked at it and said, I don't get it. Faculty, our institutional repositories should look like academic journals with curation, with editors, with peer review, with ratings, with topical highlights. That's what we're used to doing. We exist in a community of peers. And to take that information that was produced in the institution of peers and take it out of that context makes it useless to me. Remember, it's not the object that's important. It's the use of that object that's important. We need to invest in tools of creation over artifacts of others' creativity. Now, public libraries, this is the idea of bring kids who are interested in music and let them podcast and produce music, not just give them CDs. Right? We talked about the music group. We talked about businesses creating business, not reading about business. But you are in a point of creation, right? The Smithsonian is a creative place. This is not a warehouse. So where can we create? What scholarship, what knowledge can we produce? And you say, well, we do a lot of that. We have lots of scholars who come in and spend time in our libraries. Okay, give me a list of all the output that came out of that activity. Give me every paper that they published that you were a part of. Show me not only the paper they published, but what cited that paper. Show me your direct impact on the conversation of scholarship. Can you do it? The mission ultimately becomes the facilitation of knowledge creation in our community through conversation. Not the collection of, not the organization, not access to. Knowledge creation, pure and simple, number one. And the digital world is different. If you want to think about what the difference is, it's not that this is a new concept, it's the fact that wikis and blogs and web pages and all this lets us get closer to the point of scholarly foment. It lets us get to the point of knowledge creation and not the artifact after it. We're really good. Every structure about libraries is sort of like this catcher. It sits there and waits for the academic to shoot something at us. And worse, they miss often, so we also go out and collect it. But we're waiting for the output. We should be facilitating the creation. And electronic tools let us get much closer. So, quick example, Chronicle of Education editorial letter said, untenured faculty should never blog. It destroys your case. So when you go look for a job, he made two arguments. A blog will hurt your career in two ways. The first one I agree with, the second one I don't. The first one is, if you're catty and evil on your blog, people won't hire you. Right? So you go do the interview and I say, thank you very much. You walk away. First thing you're going to do is go read my blog. And you're going to find out that I hated my former professor and I did this. Right? Stupid things. Don't do stupid things. I agree with that. Second thing was, because academia only respects peer-reviewed, well-thought-through, and accepted arguments, and a blog is too formative. And I disagreed completely. Because the truth, the fun of my job, and the reason I sit on a faculty and enjoy my faculty colleagues is not because I love reading their articles when they're done. I want to read what they're thinking about now. I want to have those arguments, right? It's that Socratic method of sitting and arguing to the truth that's fun. Right? So you have put on plenty of exhibits around here where you know they've been controversial. You did them because they were controversial. You wanted to prompt a discussion. Where was the library there to make sure that they could capture the conversation, facilitate it, find out what the outcome of it was? That's the notion of the library isn't just to help the curator put together the interesting conversation. I think it also needs to be at the point of the conversation to capture it and make it available to the general world. Now, libraries are perfectly situated to do this. Perfectly situated to do this. Libraries function as authorities, not authoritarian. We have founded, through intellectual freedom, a century of tradition of being authorities in that we could give you many sides of an argument, we could give you all the provenance of the information, we could give you the citations to the information, we could give you all the markers of credibility without saying, this is the right stuff. In essence, we're the broker, honest brokers. So this whole discussion about what do we deal with the massive onslaught of information, well, the library is where you go to get the good stuff. Right? The internet's got everything. We're only going to collect the good stuff. Please define for me now good. And I tell you, you can't unless you have a context. For what? Right? So the stupid example is, a reporter goes into a library and asks for good websites on hate sites. You know, hate groups using the web to recruit members. So you send them the Ku Klux Klan website. Eighth grader comes in looking for an after-school activity. Not the same point, right? The context kind of matters in those two things. Now, we're tool builders, and I keep on a hammer on this about being tool builders because a lot of librarians look at that and instantly think that means programmers. And it does, but it means a lot more than that. If you ever did a Pathfinder, you built a tool. If you ever did a controlled vocabulary, you built a tool. If you ever did a display case, you built a tool. You're building mechanisms to help interpret people's information. Librarians, by their very nature, at the fundamental part of what we do, information organization, is a tool. We're tool builders. And we need to stop worried about, oh my God, but it's on a computer screen. That's got to stop right now. Because here's the thing. Techies never say no. Have you ever known, if you ever had a meeting, you want to do something, a techie never says no. You go, oh, yes, they do all the time. They don't do it. I said, nah. They don't say the word no. What they will do is things like, we would like to allow users to add comments to our catalog record. Techie. Well, we're going to have to worry about the firewall issue. And the firewall issue, we're going to need an LDAP, so we'll have to do authentication. And with the authentication, we may have a problem integrating that with our library system because it has underlying RDF core. But RDF doesn't, they're saying no. All right? What every librarian should do at that point is say, well, but we think it would be useful because we can build a 1-1 relationship off of our catalog record to this, and we'll keep it in an RDF format so that we can do it with the semantic triples. Right, we can go toe-to-toe with acronyms, and we should on a regular basis. But in that process, we should realize that we're tool builders. And what we need to start doing is stop riding waves and become the wave machine. Instead of looking to Google and Twitter and Facebook and say, what's new, what's new, what's new? And sailing along the shore, hoping to pick up things along the way, we need to say, wait, here's how the world works. This is where the world needs to be. Here's where we are. Here's the direction. If we need to build a new piece of software to get there, we'll build it. If we need to go and change our mission statement, we'll change it. If we need a new resource for it, we'll get it. We need to provide connective tissue to our organizations, and libraries are uniquely situated to do this. I'm just guessing there might be a little silo-esque thing going on at the museums here. Maybe not. But they all have libraries. In fact, I understand some of them have multiple libraries. What we're celebrating here is the 40th anniversary of an integrated system. That's power. What the power of an integrated system is to let the silos be silos. And we'll connect it together. And it's a vital and important function to do. We must, however, be prepared. And this is my big, big finish. I've gone too long. I apologize. We must become radical change agents. And we must think really big. Fervor is not big. All right? Tagging in the catalog is not big. Repeat after me. Lists are not big. WorldCat, not big. They're great. They're wonderful. They're incremental steps, but they're not big. It is time for us to think huge. It is time for us to think well beyond these small incremental steps. Because when we look at that future, if we simply keep looking at how we can nibble and spit integration from other groups to us, we guarantee ourselves being the second best innovators in any room because we're always following someone else. We need to talk about how we can use libraries to radicalize our communities and rule the world. We need to think in Shakespearean terms where we think about libraries and archives and museums working together not as these quaint little cultural institutions off in the corner, but the fundamental memory and focus of our civilization. That's the level we need to think about. We need to think about the mission of the library, not aiding necessarily the people in Washington, D.C., or even the nation if they come to see us through our magazine. We need to think about fundamentally improving the culture and society of which we are a part. That's the level of big we need to think about. We need to stop thinking about the process to think big and think big. We need to stop worried about the mechanisms of brainstorming and brainstorm. We need to fix our innovation economy where library vendors become marketplaces, not full solutions. When we have this situation where we have these massive monolithic systems and we hope people use them and maybe we can use part of it, forget it. We need to be talking about our integrated library system spanning thousands of different applications with one common interface. And that sounds weird and crazy and a nightmarish from a CIO perspective, but ultimately, creating these interchangeable parts saves you from things like $2 million migrations to new systems because it doesn't make sense to migrate big chunk to big chunk. It makes a lot of sense to evolve little bits and pieces along the way. We need to stop hiring our innovators and create them instead. I love the fact that you hire my students, but I run into way too many libraries that assume that they're hiring their fix, right? It's Jane, the young librarian. Jane could be 98 and on a heart-lung machine moving along, but because they just got their degree, somehow they're better attuned to the world that we're in. And so what we do is we take the most important function we have, which is the future, and we hand it to the person with the least experience, the least political capital, the least ability to change the organization and say, done. And that's insane. We need to require continuing education for all our staff on a regular basis. We need to be in the future business because we're not done yet. I love these phrases. This somehow, if you're ever in a field that's done, that means the field no longer exists. I mean, do we want to move the libraries out from behind the walls and put them on exhibit and say, this is what libraries used to look like? Then you're done. Right? Scriptoriums, done. Libraries, no way. We need to evolve on a regular basis. We need to constantly think about what's next and what's different. And we need to do it at every level. Everyone's business. So this is a quote I heard on Oprah the other day. Gratitude never radicalized anybody. It is very possible that libraries can be loved to death. And it goes like this. I don't mean we get so used we don't know what to do. I mean this. I love libraries. Right? Let me switch it to the Smithsonian. When I was 6 years old, I went to the Smithsonian with my mom and we went and we got... Have you ever been back? No, but I remember it so fondly. And they gave me this hot fudge sundae. Great. Are you a member? No, but I really love looking at the pictures. Right? This idea that the same thing with libraries. Oh, we have libraries and they're great. How do you know? I love libraries. Have you ever been to them? No. That's being loved to death. Being loved to death is becoming a spectator to your own irrelevance. There's very few people who will ever stand up and say, close the damn libraries. We hate them. Get rid of them. They love libraries. They just don't use them. I think libraries are great. They're irrelevant. These are not the conditions you need to be in. You need to be radicalized so that you say, you know what? I want you to get ticked off at the library because that at least means you're using it on a regular basis. You hate our catalog? We hate our catalog. Let's get together. Right? This is what we're talking about, this idea that somehow when if things are important to you, you get angry and passionate about them. Right? No one these days, or very few people go, John McCain, Barack Obama, such nice guys. Right? No, I want to kill that one, and I want to kill that one, and oh, they're all wrong. That passion that we like to look at and say is somehow divisive at least represents passion. Every one of your librarians should be passionate. Even if they're, whether it's the reference desk or the cataloging, they should fight every day to make their job better. They should try new stuff. And they should never, if someone goes, oh, I love the library, say, tell me why. And if you don't know, I'm going to tell you why you should love the library, and I'll see you next Tuesday downstairs. Right? Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. This concept that we have to wait for a director, no offense, that we have to wait for the supervisor, that we have to wait for Dave Lankus to come in and tell us where we're going is garbage. Just because I can speak loudly in front of a microphone makes me no more right or wrong than you. I have ideas. You hate them? Tell me you hate them. But tell me. I'm tired, and you are tired, and the people at the speech who sit in the back row, no offense, and they sit there and they go, well, that might work in your place, but it might work. Right? This is the worst thing that you can get. Right? We're going to change the world. The person in the back going, well, you change your damn world. Right? You want that person to stand up and go, no, we're not! Because at least if you're yelling, you care. Now, we could do this in a constructive, formalized way. I want to be real clear that this doesn't mean acrimony and contention and fighting. It means passion and excitement and engagement. That on a regular basis, right? I saw Roy's speech. He said, you guys come to the coolest place to work. How many times have you thought that? Probably the first week. Right? And after it was, God, the parking sucks. And boy, this is antiquated, right? You don't sit there and think, but you're sitting next to a, you're sitting next to the Muppets, right? This idea that every so often you should walk around and go, damn, this is cool, right? The fact that you're the Smithsonian, I mean, let's face it, you could have called me last night and said, Dave, we need you to get in a car and come down. I would have done it. That's power. That's what you can build on. Build on that passion. Build on that power. Take control of it. Build your future. You want to know what you're going to do in the next 40 years? First of all, you all have to agree that you'll be here in 40 years. Anyone who doesn't think we're going to be 40 years, leave the room. Then what we're going to talk about is what do you want to be in 40 years? I want to be highly paid, and I want to be thin, and I want to be blonde, right? And I want to have hair. You know what? I can do it. I can lose weight, and I can go get hair plugs, and I can dye my hair. It might cost money, and I'm not sure my wife would be that happy about the money. She'd be happy about the hair. But that's the kind of commitment we need, not sitting back and going, well, Dave's going to be fatter and balder, and that's not helpful. Be intelligent. Be aware of the trends. Be aware of the data. Know where you are. But don't pretend that that somehow dictates where you're going. You dictate where you're going. No institutional mission. No larger strategic plan. You. This idea that somehow the institution exists beyond the people in it is beyond me every time. Well, they'll never do it. Who's they? Well, the library. You're the library. Oh, right? We're a human constructed organization. Where we are and what we do is up to us. This idea, for example, do we serve the public directly or only curators? I would tell you that that's a decision that you get to make. And others would say, no. That's at least a position you should fight for if that's the way you think you should go. That's my point. Fight. Think. Do. Don't sit back. Don't wait for someone to tell you the way it's going to go. Don't follow the trend and assume it's going to take you in the right location. Don't follow. Lead. And on a regular basis, you will create the future of libraries and not have the future happen to you. Thank you very much.
All right. I said not to cut to the ending, so you see why. I'd like to invite questions, comments. I would ask you to come to the mic because we are recording. Also, I'd like to remind you that we have another speaker in our series, Clay Shirky, on November 12th. So you're all invited to that. It's going to be in the Kirby Room. And on your way out, take a ruby cookie. We have some from our gal. We have ruby slippers cookies that are quite good. But you have to come to the mic and ask a question or make a comment to get one.
And I'm very nice. I don't yell at questions, I promise you.
Well, there has to be some comment.
I'll ask the first question. I'm Ann Van Camp, and the director of the Smithsonian Institution Archives. And we've had this sort of rogue little group here at Smithsonian working on this project to put a lot of our images up on Flickr. And, you know, the response to that has been phenomenal. Huge traffic to the site, lots of, comments and tagging and all of that sort of stuff that you expect to happen. And we have absolutely no idea what to do with that. And it's sort of interesting because I think we all go back and forth about, how much should we allow the public to have some influence on what we do with our own material. Personally, I think it's great. I have no idea what to do with it either, but and a lot of it's kind of crap, but I think that we are pretty good at sorting out the wheat and the chaff and that sort of thing, but we still don't really have a very good idea of how to bring any of that into our system. And they're actually not coming back to our sites either.
Right.
So that's kind of, I don't really know what's going on there, and maybe you could say something about that.
I think there's two things. One, if you're sparking conversation, the number one thing I would worry about is capturing the conversation in the sense of having the data to analyze it, not necessarily feeling like you had to direct it, not necessarily feeling like one use is better than the other, but at least track it. I'm going to go to library catalog for a moment, clearly, but it makes sense for a second. It used to be that we talked in library world, and I think we talk a lot in information industries writ broad, about noise reduction. The idea that what we want to do through systems, through time, is we want to reduce noise. And one could argue that what you're generating is a lot of noise. Right? A lot of people are out there and they're doing a lot of stuff, but it's not a very coherent, melodious thing. It's just a lot of stuff. And I think that the reason that we built this concept of reducing noise through classification, through cataloging, through all this stuff, is that we assumed that we didn't have systems that could support the noise. And what I want you to do is think about two different systems. One is, imagine if I give you one task. I sent you into Union Station at rush hour, and I told you to capture every conversation going on. Ugh, right? You would probably do, if you really, made you do it, you would want to do is stand up with a bullhorn and go, everyone stop. Business conversations over here, personal conversations over here. And what you would begin to do is subdivide them into small enough groups that you could walk up and say, now, what are you talking about? And truth be told, that's about all you could do in that environment. But as we're sitting here speaking, well, actually, we're about three floors under the ground, but theoretically speaking, thousands of radio waves are going through your body right now with people on conversations from cell phones, on the radio, on, the FBI is hanging around, whatever it is. And they're not interfering with this conversation. To capture those, you have a piece of technology called a tuner, a radio tuner, or a cell phone that allows you to tune into the conversation you want. You don't want it, you tune into another conversation. On the radio dial, you can even co-locate things regardless of where they are on the spectrum. These are the kinds of systems we need to talk about, which is let the noise happen. we have systems right now that we can't deal with the noise because everything we have is built about reducing the noise through curatorial voice, through classification for reduction of information. It's all about reducing it down to some capturable conversation. What we need to start building is systems to allow the noise. And part of the problem is, do you have a mechanism to bring Flickr data back onto your site? Right? We've got systems to get it out to Flickr. Do we have this ability where we can highlight the last three comments done on this image where we're just pulling directly from an RSS feed coming from Flickr, right? So that we can, you know, co-brand the two together. And I think that it's really important not to fight Flickr to create your own photo sharing site. Absolutely the right way to do it. Now what you do is send your curators back through all that noise and let them start picking out, and you're not necessarily, you could be the curator, to go in and begin to highlight parts of that conversation which leads to recognition of that community. That in essence, you're curating the conversation. Doesn't mean limiting, doesn't mean stopping, doesn't mean reducing the noise, but you're building sort of, these are interesting paths through this that we hadn't thought of. And we don't have systems that do that very well. We need better systems to do that. And Flickr provides some of them through tagging. But what you can do in Flickr is you can sort of pick a tag and show all the images or comments around the tag. What you want to be able to say is, I want that image with that comment, that image with that comment, that image, and tie them together in a semantic way, which technologies like RDF and such allow you to do. But I think what we need to do is build systems that allow for thousands of simultaneous conversations with good discovery tools so people can filter through them. That's a one of these. If you want to get down to one of these, I can show you examples.
I appreciated what you said about needing to, for the library or some entity, to take the scientific output that we are creating and put it somewhere. There's also a need to capture them at a different level so that Tuesday, I mean, to show our relevance, you have to say how that information is being used. Mm-hmm. The original article, you know, may seem kind of dry to Congress. Oh, so they classified another bunch of shrimp. You know, what you need to do is to show how others around the world are using the information.
Right.
Is there anything concrete in development that will allow to make it easier to do that?
You know what's remarkable is that there's something that's allowed us to do that for a couple of decades called Web of Science. Of course, it wasn't Web of Science when it started, but the social science and science citation abstracts. We spent a lot of time focusing on the front pieces of material, titles, authors, ISBN numbers, page counts, when all the real interesting stuff was in the back, citations. And I think citations are a quick, easy way to do it. The problem is that let's say that I come into the system, I come in the Smithsonian system and I pull up the shrimp classification Del Fuego article of the month. I might be able to, if it's full text, I could probably get in there and find the citations. It would be nice if they were automatically linked to other materials. But finding it forward gets much harder, right? Because it's sort of a dead end for us. Because we don't capture that along the path. The scholarly communication and how it gets applied is a conversation, communication. And the way in which we build upon that conversation, that memory in a relational way, is through citation. And so I think that the library system should focus on citations. We shouldn't, in essence, buy those and hope someone captures them. We should pick what's important and follow them. The other part of that is that that was written by a scholar, and you probably have your claws into that scholar for some reason, and they do care a lot about how their work gets pushed forward. And so making them part so that you can tap them on a regular basis and say, how did this get used? How did that get used in 5 and 10 years? And then being able to capture those stories that you can then take into Congress, I think, is important. But part of it is we need to be much smarter in the idea that we have impact with our materials. We don't simply describe them. And that means you begin to capture conversational clues like citations. You begin to capture people's navigation and ideation through it. You begin to capture the scholar's work and workflow. So. Because if you didn't like it, you got to tell me, folks.
Oh, no, I liked your talk. That's loud. Actually, can I work without a microphone? I'm pretty loud voice.
I think you're going to get...
I consider myself a pretty proactive librarian. I've started at the Smithsonian 4 months ago, and I still every day go, this is so cool, I love it. But you actually, I thought, brought some of the ideas to the next level, which, like I said, I need to absorb. Is this type of librarianship you're talking about, this
participatory or librarianship, is that being taught now? Libraries still have been out for about 8 years.
This is a concept that clearly has historical roots in lots of different places, but as this thing called participatory librarianship, we've been really at the end of a 3-year process where I've been going out and doing my evangelist thing and writing some articles and white papers. And actually my next step is to create what I call the starter kit. And the starter kit is going to be taking some of the real examples from what we learned at Department of Justice and Philly Free and OCLC and sort of writing them up. But rather than just me writing them and publishing as a book, what we want to do is get institutions who can sort of give feedback on the way. You know, here's what I thought, here's your feedback, go forth, and then we create really an online community, which is that. So this is a place where you can find out more information. We want to build, just started a Facebook area where we can have people talk about it. And frankly, looking for lots of ideas on how we can take it to the next level. But one of the things I wouldn't say it's being taught yet, but I'm doing my best but I'm doing my best to get more. But it really is, I think, it builds on the best of librarianship, but really does sort of, is a radical idea when you get down to how you begin to apply it and run it. So I'm looking for help.
I mean, look, and I think with all the other things a lot of us have to do, it takes a lot more time. I also think it makes our jobs more interesting. One of the things I did in my previous job was I did a collection management talk on our bona fide literature. And that led me actually to do research on the history of bona fide literature in Japan and in the United States. So that's actually how my talk evolved. And then I found unique materials in our collection to present. So
Right. It
made the job a lot, my job a lot more interesting to do that. It took a lot of time.
You bring up two really important points. One is how we prepare folks for doing this. And I think that time is an important question, right? So time, in terms of preparation, how we prepare students, we don't have enough time. The number one complaint, there's the classic field versus the academy in terms of how we prepare librarians. And it's a false argument. Because in truth, librarians will stand up and say, you're not teaching enough of this. And then you'll have an academic who will say, you're right, we're not teaching enough of this. The problem is we don't have enough time to teach it all. Right? Our focus at the master's level is right now on access and process. And what it needs to be is on change and managing the change and innovation. And to do that, we need to talk about how we can break out of this model. So one way we do it now isn't good, which is we do 2.5 years of preparation, that's all you're required, and then we hope that we catch up through informal sessions like this that are uncoordinated, you'll keep up to speed. What we need to do is talk about, do we need an undergraduate that handles the process issues? Do we do a master's level that deals with the management and innovation issues, and then have a professional doctorate that deals with the theoretical and conceptual issues, and we have coordinated education systems throughout, right? And I've seen some libraries, I assume you guys have a continuing education system within your own library system, but we need to see if we can spread that wider. The second is time of the day, right? How do librarians engage this? And I would argue that there's two really uncomfortable things that need to happen. The first is we need to look at everything we're spending our time on and say, do we need to do it? The two most important questions that a librarian needs to ask today, and frankly, a librarian, a curator, a dad, a mom, are why and why not? Look at everything you're doing and say, why am I doing this? Right? So, for example, I heard a library that talked about collection maintenance. And collection maintenance was, whenever you asked the librarian what they were doing, they'd say collection maintenance. And whenever you tried to find out what collection maintenance was, you couldn't. Because it wasn't shelving, it wasn't weeding, it wasn't really dusting. I think it was sort of, don't bother me, it's free time. And to be truthful, you need free time. I mean, one of the problems that we have is if you're so busy in process and doing something, you have time to innovate because you can't think about something. So I'm a big believer in taking, I'd love it if it were a day a week, but at the very least 2 or 3 hours a week where you set someone into a room and say, play, and just think of new ideas. The why not is, I think too often we answer that question before we've asked it out loud. So, why, Department of Justice has this wonderful website with pathfinders and materials that are available behind the firewall. And one of the problems they have is they can't maintain the systems to do it because they're sort of these antiquated systems where they go to a wiki site or Flickr or Blogster and have all the tools they need to do it better right now, but it's outside of the firewall. Now, all the information on this is pathfinder and general stuff, but the librarians don't want to do it. And when I said, well, why not? They said, because the lawyers won't let us. The lawyers. The lawyers would love it because they could do it from home and they could do it in the field offices and everything else. They answer the question, why not, before they actually ask the question. And I think all too often, we never ask that why not question, or we go to one source and we get shot down and we stop. I mean, it can be really frustrating, right? My father's favorite joke was, how do you tell a pioneer? He's the one with the arrows in his ass, right? Which, when you're trying something new, people are going to shoot you down on a regular basis, and that can be tiring and frustrating. But I think that if we looked at it, how much time do we spend in metadata maintenance? How much time when we could crowdsource a lot of that? And I'm not saying, oh my God, we're going to go to, you know, tagging instead of any sort of intellectual organization. No, but how much time do you spend on intellectual organization with cataloging that your curators spend on it in putting in terms of collection, that your users do in terms of their dissemination? You're duplicating so much effort. Can't we just sort of look at a workflow that captures all of that, or at least, and then preferences one versus the other? So it does take a lot of time. But if you're participating, you have a community, you also then get to distribute the workload to that community. That right now, this is that service thing. We take the question, we assume we own the question, it's ours. We call it the greedy librarian problem. We greedily take a question, and we solve it, and we fight like hell to solve it, and we never want to give it up, when we could have walked across and asked someone else, and they would have given us the answer in 10 seconds. We need to say it's okay for us to say, I don't know, or let's bring a group in to deal with it. And we need tools to more efficiently bring these groups together, whether physically or virtually, to do it. So it's a context-specific answer, so I can't tell you don't do this. But I'll tell you one, don't spend so much time on the catalog. That's me. Yeah, I know. I would rather you take 90% of the effort you're doing in fighting for shopping for you guys are looking for an integrated library system, right? Okay. Take 90% of the time you're doing in shopping and comparing and getting RFPs and spend that coming up with your own specifications to hand back and say, this is what we want. I think all too often we don't do that. We assume that we have to buy something, and we don't. We can build it. And we can build it with lots of off-the-shelf pieces. So, another story. I really have very few opinions I share with the world.
I love many of your opinions. Thank you. I'm Andrew now, and I represent a number of those many libraries in the Natural History Museum. And I love the picture of the Free Public Library of Philadelphia, because it really, in a sense, captures where we are in terms of my particular situation, the fact that we are undergoing a very massive rebuilding project into new space of spaces that are in almost 100-year-old building.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I am very interested in finding out any kind of reaction you could have in bringing together some of your points on the pressure to participate, the future in everyone's business, and social capital, and translating that into physicality.
Mm-hmm. Space
physicality.
That's actually exactly what we did with the Free Library of Philadelphia. They have a 100-year-old Beaux-Arts building, and they got agreements to go out and raise, originally it was 70, but now it's $110 million to expand the central building. So what they're going to do is build, of course, the brand new, really cool building sort of seamlessly attached to the old one. In fact, they have a wall full of all this metal shelving that turns out that it's actually structural. So they've got to, like, cut through it. But that was the question, because what happens is when we first started, so they went and got the star-architect. I love that phrase from the New York Times, right? The architect who's a star. It's all about. And they rolled out the plans, and all the librarians originally looked, and number one thing in their mind was that they had expanded from 4 million volumes to 9 million volumes. That was the number one thing on their mind. And so what they did when they looked at the architectural plans is they said, we can move these books over here, move these books over here, and compact shelving all over here. So $110 million, brand new building full of compact shelving. Yay. And so, but they had the question, well, what else do you do? You know, this is back to a lot of that language where I showed you, you know, pointing to the stars and thinking about the trenches. We have a lot of people that tell you this brand inspiration, where does it go? So that was our question. So, for example, the entrepreneurium, first thing we did was we identified we called it conversational analysis. We identified significant conversations going on. That's not stakeholder analysis, because most of the time conversations span stakeholders. right? So, for example, if you have a new exhibit, you have the curator having a voice into it, you have the visitors having a voice in it, you have the finance people having a voice in it, right? So it's not just what the stakeholder, what conversations are going on. For each one of those conversations, how well can we understand what the needs and parts of that conversation are, and then link it specifically to service? So, for example, we identified the business community. Economic development in the urban core of Philadelphia is huge, right? As is violence, and youth activities. As is writing, because they have an amazing writing program and they have a very energized writing community and a music community. So they identify these significant communities, all right? Really conversations around. And then they went to those conversations and they said, all right, what do we need within it? How do we facilitate it? So I'm going to take the business example. The business example is we identified that we needed to talk to entrepreneurs and people starting up businesses, not established businesses. Right? Went through a little bit of that logic. But that was talking with the community itself. We formed you could call it an advisory board, but really it was the governance structure, which was the business librarian and the entrepreneurs sitting together making decisions. In the music community, they wanted a curator. They wanted someone, that was their model of governance. They wanted someone to say good or bad what gets performed and not. The business community wanted business people. The writing community wanted nothing to do with governance whatsoever. They were so tired of being rejected by publishers, the last thing they wanted was to be rejected by their public library when they talked about on-demand printing. So they wanted, like, email us every so often, we trust you. And so once we identified this, the business community said we have these board, and then we sat down and said, all right, conversations about how to start a small business. You guys have started a small business. How did you move through that process? And they said, the first thing we did was we needed to know what a business plan was. There aren't any good books about it. I wanted actual business plans. Okay, that's a part of a collection, but it's a class. The next thing we needed was a physical space to do it. All right, what do you mean? I needed a place that I could do in private, work on my business plan, collect quietly, and in public, learn from each other and share information. And I needed field trips out of the library to places that were actually doing. So by walking through that conversation of what it took to become an entrepreneur, in essence, a curriculum to structure and build knowledge in that community, it dictated the physical space. Cubicle-esque, but pretty. Community spaces and boardrooms they could talk about. So when you look at the community, what is their working mode? Is it a private work? Is it a public work? Do they want to get together? When do they need those physical spaces? And how are you moving the conversations? The writers wanted two rooms. They wanted a quiet room that was just a place to write, no materials whatsoever, and they wanted a salon with tons of literary magazines everywhere and outside of glass cases. And they wanted in comfy chairs because that's how people talked about literature at Barnes & Noble. And so that's the notion of how you build the physical space from the conversation. And yes, the conversations are going to shift and change. And there's been some good work on physical locations, like you never build a wall if you don't have to. You build partitions. You build lots of comfortable seating. You build a place where they can bring food. I mean, that's just sort of general how social beings like to work. But the number one thing that we underestimate, and architects will always underestimate, is the need for personal space. Architects hate personal space because it breaks vision lines. It breaks up their beautiful architecture to have a quiet cubby. And yet, quiet cubbies, you need a lot to synthesize. So it's a process as opposed to the answer, but it's all context.
Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you again.